Welcome to the Leadership Mindset, the podcast where we uncover the hidden gems of sales and business leadership. Our goal is to bring you up close and personal with the world's most accomplished business leaders. We explore their experiences, motivations, inspirations, and the challenges they've conquered on their way to the top. In today's episode, you can expect to learn about the transformative power of servant leadership, the importance of leading by example, and the value of adaptability and continuous improvement in both military and corporate settings. So put the kettle on and enjoy this episode with today's guest, Andy Champion.
Andy Champion, you're very welcome to the podcast.
Good morning, Paul. Thank you so much.
A lot of glowing. By the way, I only picked out a fraction. In fact, what I found when I was looking at them was that I had to just take the first line from deep recommendations, and then there was so many of them. What I noticed was that there was a trend in there, and a lot of it was around motivation, charisma, and ability to get the most out of people. Where do you think that comes from in you?
Firstly, I'm hugely humbled by what people have said. I hope that I live up to those glowing words. And certainly that's something deep within me, right, is a desire to be that strong leader, to be the best version I can of myself for my people. So where does it come from? I think that I have a view on leadership that I'm here to serve, right? And that's probably something that was reinforced right back after I left university at Sandhurst. And the motto of Sandhurst is to serve, to lead. And so I think that servant approach to leadership is something that's stuck with me throughout. I'm not there to always be the brightest person in the room. In fact, my job as a leader is not to be the brightest person in the room. My job is very much to facilitate the conversations and help drive that outcome that we're all seeking. So I think a lot of it comes from perhaps the past experience, but also my views in terms of what leaders are there to do.
Now, I'm curious about that because I don't think most people are born with that understanding of what leadership is and what great leadership is. Where do you think yours comes from? What were some of the early influences that have led you to that?
For sure, I touched on it. My time in the military, right? That was formative for me. I was in my early 20s and I came straight out of university, went straight to Sandhurst. Then it was a seven-month course that taught you the basics of being a leader in the British military. And then shortly after that, I was posted to Northern Ireland in the early 90s. It was still a very troubled part of our country with two communities that basically were really struggling to understand each other, had deeply held views that were generations old. And that was impacting the ability of people to live their daily lives, right? And so I was thrust into the middle of that, early 20s, with a platoon of 30 guys. I was in the infantry, so it was all men. And we were there to help the police do their job. And I got to go to some of the most troubled areas, West Belfast, South Armagh. I spent a lot of time around Newry, where the police weren't always welcome, right? And we were there to help keep them safe and provide public order so that people could go about their daily lives. And that was a huge responsibility, right? I'd never led teams of people of that size. I played a lot of sport. And so that collaboration in sport, team sports, rugby is there. Everyone has their particular role. But I'd not done it genuinely a life or death situation. So I was very fortunate. I had an incredible platoon sergeant who was 16 years into his career, Sergeant Sassoli. I still remember to this day the first conversations I had with him. And we hit it off from the start. And he really helped me understand what good leadership looked like. And so I think that was a very first and early influence for me. I think then after I came out of the army and I went into the commercial world, I started out in sales recruitment. And having led large teams up to 120 people in the army, I was then an individual contributor. And my first job coming out of the army was effectively to be a BDR for a sales recruitment company. So I was making 100 dials a day. That was my target, dials, not connects. And there was no internet. So it's not like you go on LinkedIn and find out people's titles, people's roles. You had to do that by looking in things like the Compass Directory, in Yellow Pages, scanning the job sections in local newspapers. And it was really humbling, right? It really helped ground me and provided me with some commercial experience. And then I think as I took on various different roles and grew my career, there was a bit of trial and error, applying certain principles, seeing what worked, what didn't. And I think that then magnified those early influences, right, about not having to be the smartest guy in the room, about being open and humble and transparent. So I think it's been a progressive journey for me, like it is for many people. But I was so fortunate to have those early influences, key people, like I say, like Sass Lyset, that really helped guide and shape me.
Okay. Just listen, there's so much there, Andy, I want to talk about. Let's go back to Northern Ireland, and I'll start there and explore with you. What I'm really curious about is what you learned about yourself and about humanity by being putting into that kind of a cauldron. And then you mentioned your sergeant, lessons you got from him. I'd like to understand that. And then what I'm also fascinated by is you're now on the end of a phone as a BDR, and you're talking to people who are, we've all been through this where you're getting, where did you get my number from? And that kind of, sometimes bordering on nasty, and party must be going, you know, the soldier in you, that individual must be wanting to reach down the phone and strangle them and call them. And just that frustration, I can't imagine what that tension must be like. Let's go back to Northern Ireland. What did you learn about yourself? Because it's one thing to go through an academy and learn about leadership. There's another thing to be thrown in at the deep end. And also what you learned about humanity in that experience?
God, we could fill a whole hour with that one topic, right? I think that one of the things I learned about myself throughout that journey was that there are depths available to all of us that are beyond what we mentally might be aware of. So what do I mean by that? Physically, mentally, we're actually much, much stronger than perhaps some of our beliefs would sometimes indicate, right? Sometimes that belief of, I can't climb that mountain, or I'm nervous about that call. I need to get my boss in to join me on it. Actually, when you're put in situations where you have little option but to push through, but to figure out the answer, the depths of reserves, as I say, mentally and physically, they're in all of us. But traditionally, most of our day-to-day lives don't require us to draw upon them. So I think that was certainly one of the things that I learned, not only about myself, but other people. People have this innate ability to astonish and surprise you. And it's such a fantastic thing. Now, sometimes they can surprise you in a positive way, sometimes in a less positive way. But those depths, the strength of character, physically and mentally, are way beyond what any of us think. And then one of the other things I learned very clearly was the importance of being able to lead by example. We're incredibly privileged. Some of us are incredibly privileged to lead teams and lead people. It's a position of deep responsibility. But one of the principles that I've always tried to live by is never to ask anybody in my team to do anything that I'm not prepared to do myself. Doesn't mean I have to do it better than them. Certainly doesn't mean I have to tell them how to do it. Again, that's not my job. But I've at least got to be able to be willing to do it myself. Asking people to lead a patrol into a difficult or challenging area, we had to do that all the time. And typically we worked in teams of 12 that were split into sub-teams of 4. And within a team of 4, typically there will be one person leading the way at the front. And realistically, that's probably one of the more dangerous areas to be, right? And if you think about, I never served in the Middle East, but if you think about some of the IEDs and some of the horrific injuries that some of our armed forces suffered from bombs that were buried in the ground, right? Typically, it's the lead person that is at most risk. So again, as a leader, I needed to be prepared on occasion to be that lead guy, to be the point man at the front of the patrol, leading the way. Typically, it's not a great place as a leader to stand because you have less perspective of what's going on around you. Sometimes you need to be prepared to do that. And sometimes you need to be prepared to do that when the danger is perhaps slightly higher. Because again, you're leading by example and you're setting the tone. And you're saying, guys, I'm in this with you. I'm prepared to do everything you do and give all of myself for us and for the team.
That's about respect building, I presume.
Yeah, I think respect is something that you earn, right? You can't demand it, but you can create an environment where you have the ability to earn it. Yeah.
Yeah. What would you say, though, to in military units, it's self-selecting. You weren't picked off the street for that role, where in sales, it's not so self-selecting. People are put into situations that they didn't prepare for and they didn't train for. And now you're helping them discover that they can go further than they believed they could before. How do you translate that, what you learned in the military, to civilian life where people who just wouldn't be literally battle-hardened as well as figuratively battle-hardened, how do you help them discover that they can go further than they've ever believed possible?
I think the parallels are pretty acute. And I would say, actually, I think that not all of us, but some of us do self-select into sales, right? Not all, but we make conscious decisions to further our careers, and some people do extremely well at it over many years. And of course, like anything in life, you build up a bank of experience. And so what I would say is, much like in my early military career, I had a platoon sergeant who was able to help guide, steer and influence me and help me develop as a young officer. I think in many ways, there are some parallels there with great first line managers, right? And second line and third line managers, to help give people the confidence and to create a safe environment where people are prepared to take an educated chance. People are prepared to try something new. And sometimes that's going to work. And you know what? Sometimes it might not work. And we might fall over, a bit like riding a bike. We might fall off and graze on our knees. And that's okay. The job of a sales manager is to create that safe environment where people can make those choices and where they can learn from them when perhaps they don't go perfectly. And I think that's a little bit like the relationship that I had with my platoon sergeant. I was learning about leadership on the job. And sometimes he would guide. Sometimes he would say, no, boss, you really don't need to do it like that. Be a little bit more directive. And sometimes he would allow things to play out. The interesting dynamic there, of course, was that technically he reported into me. But one of the things I realized really early on was I had so much to learn from this guy, 16 years of experience in the military. I would be foolish to ignore that. And I saw some young officers that unfortunately did that. Their egos got in the way.
That actually, there's a parallel with that, because you're in a position of leadership in the military. Now you come out and you're sitting at a desk with compass and clippings. And what's that? Talk me through that. What's that like to go from that position where you are? I know you're not always in control, you're in the military, but they train you for those situations of dealing with the ambiguity and lack of control and to put boundaries around that. And now you're in this at this desk. What's going through your mind?
Firstly, what does good look like? What am I expected to deliver? And how am I expected to deliver? And how do I get to that point as quickly as possible? Right? Because I want to do a job. It's important to me. I'm very internally motivated. So for me, there's a strong driver within me that is always pushing me to be better at what I do. I don't have to be perfect. I try and make progress every single day, little small increments here and there. But that's an internal driver. So for me, that came out loud and clear. It's, how do I master this job? How do I go from a guy that's been in the military that kind of knows how to do a foot patrol around West Belfast? How can I then get to that same level of competence in my new role which is about engaging with, typically it was sales leaders, to identify where they had open roles, where we as a recruitment company could put candidates in front of them. And then how do you break that down? How do you break that down into the different tasks? Gathering the data, getting the information, the names, the phone numbers, getting an understanding of the business. Nowadays, right, we can go on the internet and we can look up highspot.com and you can understand within, hopefully, our website will help you understand within 30 seconds what we do. Websites weren't there. You never quite knew what the business was that you were calling into. You never quite had that same insight into the person that you were going to speak to. But what you could do is you could structure your day. There were certain things that you could control. I could control what time I arrived at the office in the morning and whether I was the first person to get at the newspapers or not. And that had, I found, an impact on my ability to drive success. Because if I got there first, I could get the clippings and I could then be not necessarily competitive with my other internal colleagues, but competitive with other firms out there, with other people like me doing that job. And I think when you play that forward to today and you look at the exciting but demanding role that our SDRs, BDRs have, it's a similar analogy. How do you stand out from a crowd in a world where there's a lot of cold outreach going on, whether by video, by email, or whatever channel it might be? How could I stand out from the crowd? How could I be that person that got in early ahead of everybody else and had a meaningful, thoughtful approach to the conversation that I wanted to have?
Yeah. Sounds to me, sorry, Andy, I didn't mean to cut across you. You were going to say?
No, so I was saying that it was a humbling experience for me, going from a place where I was doing a reasonable job and hopefully my guys that I served would say that I served them well, to going to a net new role where I knew very little, where I had no frame of reference, where I didn't understand, in the early days at least, what it took to be successful.
Yeah. What I'm curious about is where you go from a position where there is a relative status that's well-defined and where everything is well-structured to one of quite a lot of ambiguity. And what I heard you say was that you took that militaristic approach of what's the mission? What are the tasks? What do I got to achieve? Who do I serve as the answer to that?
Yeah, I learned that framework, if you like, in the military, but I don't think it's exclusive to the military.
No.
Yeah, I think that being thoughtful about what it is we're trying to achieve in any given task, whether that's over the course of a day, a month, a year, doesn't matter, having an objective that everybody knows and understands, that people have bought into the creation of that objective and feel as though they've had their voice heard, that they, where they understand their particular contribution and why it matters, but also, as I touched upon earlier, that they also understand that if that involves taking risk, it's okay to do, right? It's hard to improve unless sometimes you push yourself beyond the boundaries that we think we all have. And so I think that framework for me, yes, came from the military, but I also think it's a framework you can sort of pick up elsewhere. And I'd argue if you don't have a plan, if you don't have objectives, as an individual, it's hard enough to be effective, let alone when you lead teams.
Yeah. I think what I'm hearing is that there is a framework there for people who find themselves going from a position of relative familiarity and certainty to one of less certainty and more ambiguity, that the answer in that transition is in having that framework to enable them to transition. That's what I'm taking from it. It's not about the military as much as it is about they're also leveraging this framework because it works. Before we get into your current role, what I wanted to do is just go back a little bit further, because you said something, you said that a lot of your motivation is internal and that you're driven to be better. Sometimes that drive to be better comes from some deep subconscious feeling that I'm not quite enough. And I'm just curious to know if that was something that you've experienced. If so, where do you think it comes from?
I don't know that it comes from a feeling of not quite being enough. But then again, I'm not sure I could precisely pinpoint where it comes from. I've always been competitive. I've right from an early age, I enjoyed competitive sports, both team-based sports that I really enjoyed. I've talked about rugby. I also played hockey. I wasn't great at cricket, but I enjoyed cricket. But I've also competed as an athlete. I did field athletics when I was young. I was relatively tall for my age, and so I did shot put. And then when everybody else grew taller than me, I had to change quite quickly because actually the point of release, the height of release, amongst other things for shot put, really does have a strong determinant on how far you throw the thing. So I had to change to hammer, which is the ball on the end of a big long wire, and you just spin round in a circle and hope the thing flies out through the gate and doesn't smash into the net, because that's always embarrassing when that happens, let alone if it bounces back and lands on you. So I've always had that sort of drive, that innate instinct. And sometimes that's been to be competitive with other people. And I think, like many people, I don't like to lose. But equally, it's important. It's as important for me to win in the right way as it is to win. Right? Win at all costs, I think, can be quite damaging. But as I've got older, as I've gone on, it's been less about competing with others. But I think it, for me, it's rationalized and refined itself in terms of just being that little bit. It's a bit corny, but just trying to be the best that I can be, given the skills and the talents and the experiences I've had. I don't have to be the best ever. I just need to be the best version of me.
Do you find then that you're now you've transitioned that to a place in sales leadership where instead of competing with people, you're competing for people, your team, that you're there to help them compete for themselves?
100%. 100%. As I said, I think as a leader, I'm there to serve the team that I'm fortunate enough to lead, not the other way around. And I think that comes down to, I often describe it as, I'm not there to tell the people that I work with how to do their job. I'm certainly not there to do their job for them. But I am there to help them do it more effectively than if I wasn't here. And sometimes that means getting out ahead of them and removing obstacles. Sometimes that's sitting down with them and working through step by step the challenges they face. I had an example of that this morning where one of the team called me up. They got a particular challenge with a deal, and we spent 15 minutes just brainstorming different ideas, different approaches. And that helped her get to a place where she's now got clarity of the next step. Yeah. I didn't tell her what to do, right? And that wasn't the goal of the call. My goal was to help her assess the situation, because she's way closer to the deal than I am.
Yeah.
And help her work through the options and how they might play out so that she could come to, in this case, the plan that she's going to go forward and execute later on tomorrow and on Friday.
Was that difficult, moving from a position where you could command people what to do to one where it doesn't work the same way?
Not for me, because whilst I think in the military you have the ability to tell people what to do, good leaders, at least in my book, inspire people. And the data sample's not huge here, right? It's one person. My experience is that when you motivate people, when you create an environment where they really want to lean in, you get this thing called discretionary effort. Right. And that is the effort that people put in above and beyond the minimum required of them. It's when they take that extra initiative to do something that actually they didn't have to do. Nobody told them what, and sometimes people don't even see what that might be, but they go that extra step. And I think great leaders inspire their teams and their people to put that discretionary effort in. And for me, that's always been the kind of soft KPI that I look for. Are people really bought into where we're going? Do they feel they have a voice? Do they feel they can have a difference? And am I seeing it in their day-to-day actions? Yeah. Are they going above and beyond?
Speaking of inspiration, who was in your life that has inspired you the most?
Sergeant Lysa, SAS Lysa, for sure. I think that he, as I said, helped shape me early in my career. I also am inspired by, and I've never met people like the Dalai Lama, right? A life of service. And it doesn't really matter to me whether you're religious or not. The fact that an individual could be so thoughtful about life and can just bring a really interesting perspective, a different perspective. I think people like Barack Obama, I had a question actually, I did an Ask Me Anything session with the EMEA team a few weeks back, and they asked me a similar question. What were the three people you'd have dinner with if you could have just three people from anywhere in history? And I chose Barack Obama, I chose the Dalai Lama, and I also chose Winston Churchill. Now, Winston Churchill actually is quite a provocative choice. And I think that the reality is that if we projected some of his values and beliefs in today's society, some of those would be uncomfortable. And I get that. But equally, I think when we look back, particularly to the Second World War, and the leadership, the selfless leadership that he provided for the country, he was a man of that moment. I think it is with that specific, very specific perspective that I think I have a lot of respect for what he was able to achieve for the UK and arguably the democratic Western world.
Does it worry you or bother you at all then when you see certain sections of society which didn't exist that long ago now feeling that the answer to their problems are to pull down statues of people like Churchill, not necessarily him, but people like him who were of their time and not understand the new ones?
I think, to broaden your question slightly, I think we are stronger when we stand together as a society. And part of that is understanding history so that we don't make those same mistakes again. And that can be applied to how people of different color have been treated in the past, which is abhorrent. But also, it goes way beyond that, right? Sexuality, religion, all of those things. I think as a society, we can learn from how people's with diversity have suffered in the past. I also think it has a particular resonance for me around the problems that we face as a globe, whether it's global warming, whether it's COVID. We as a species, I think, are stronger and are better able to address those challenges the more we collaborate, the more we come together. And I am troubled by the way that nations are becoming broadly more nationalistic. I'm troubled at the prospect that the United Kingdom, having left Europe, may now fragment and may see Scotland depart the United Kingdom. Not because I have a particularly nationalistic or new view. I just think that we're stronger when we come together as people across our nations, across the colors of our skin, across our religions, across our sexuality, and all the other things that there is far more that unites us that divides us.
Yeah.
And I think we sometimes focus on what divides us rather than what unites us.
I'm wondering how much of that, though, is down to people's innate inability to think critically. And maybe it's just because it's not taught in any schools, where people are so easily influenced, they're so easily led by malevolent characters. And there's always only a small number of them who have a particular agenda. And what they'll do is they'll set up this bogeyman. It could be the EU, it could be any, there's any number of bogeymen. And it's this bogeyman is out to get you. And people swallow that hook, line, and sinker, and there's no critical thinking. And they see now with social media having replaced a lot of newspapers, it's even more so because the newspapers are looking for clickbait. They have to survive, and therefore they become more sensationalist. I saw this only last week. It was here in Ireland. We had 25 people leave hospital and 5 were admitted. To me, that's a net gain of 20. That's a great news story. But no, it's like worrying trend, 5 new people admitted to hospital, right? And so you have that, and then people read that without thinking it through and going to go, hang on a second here, what's the story, what's the reality? And I'm curious to know, in your life experience, where you see that, where you see it going, and but more importantly, how do you feel we could halt it? If you agree at all, even, that it's a problem.
Yeah, I think that a lot of the way that society has developed over the last 20 or 30 years, and arguably probably longer than that, but my perspective is limited to that sort of time period, so I'll comment on that, not on hundreds of years. But I would argue that what I may have experienced over the last 20 or 30 years is a society that has become much more used to our every desire being immediately answered or fulfilled. Crude analogies here, but if you want to know who won the 1966 World Cup.
Hang on a second.
You know why I'm mentioning it? Because it's the last time that England won it, right? Not that I'm a football fan, but there we go. But if you didn't know that, do you know what? It would take you about 10 seconds to pick up your phone to probably go to somewhere like Google to learn that. And that thirst for knowledge can be immediately satisfied. You want to know what that song is that's playing in the restaurant, right? You get Shazam up and bang, you get that immediate answer. Tell you what, let's take that forward to how we consume food, right? Brands like Uber Eats and Deliveroo. You want to have a Chinese or an Indian takeaway or a Persian meal if you're in one of the areas that they cover, you can probably have that delivered within half an hour, maybe even sooner than that. You want to buy certain goods with Amazon, you can certainly have it delivered in 24 hours, sometimes in some areas like central London within 2 hours. And that immediate satisfaction of desires, thirst for knowledge, food, whatever it might be, technology has enabled that. But I think it's also perhaps trained us in a certain way to look for quick fixes, immediate answers. And so what I would say is, per your point about critical thinking, sometimes the quick answer is not always the best answer. Sometimes the best things in life, in your career, you have to put time and effort into, right? It's really hard to shortcut the knowledge you need to get to be effective as an account manager, as an SDR, as a sales rep, as a leader, right? Because actually, the sum of those experiences help you get better at what you do. Same thing for playing a piano, right? It's very difficult to sit down there and immediately master the thing. You have to put hours and hours of time into that. And maybe there's a few things that can accelerate it, but there are also some things that might look attractive shortcuts, but may ultimately lead to a more difficult or perhaps compromised outcome.
Yeah, that's for sure. Actually, you're pointing out my piano dilemma, where I got this sheet music, and it, to make it easier for you, it takes all of the sharps and flats and puts them in red. So it speeds up. But also, it you miss out. There's no question about it. And I see it as well in hobbies I have, like photography, where everything in that was designed to give you the picture, the instant, or the back of the screen, where before it's the delayed gratification of waiting and spending time on something. And so I think you're right about it. I think that is a huge issue, and it's not reversing anytime soon. I would like to see maybe more in schools people those question.
Yeah, and by the way, look, I think broadly a lot of that progress is great. It can be truly, truly satisfying. But it does change perhaps how we might approach certain situations. Growing up, I learned my timetables by rote. I learned a lot of the facts. Schooling, when I was at school, was about filling your mind with all sorts of facts and figures. I would argue that's less important now. As you say, it's about those that ability to think critically. It's about the ability to know where to go to get the answers, to get the information, and then interpreting that information. And I think that definitely has helped propel us forward as a society. And I think it's a fascinating change, and it's been a very swift change that certainly my kids have experienced in terms of their education is wholly different to that I experienced just a couple of generations ago.
I think what we're seeing is, though, is this emerging tension between that, the desire to think critically and question things, with sections of society. A lot of that is in academia, is that there's an established narrative and that's what's accepted and anything else isn't, which is, but that's all another kettle of fish probably for another day. Tell me a little bit about High Spot. What are your ambitions for it?
So we're in a really interesting position. I've always enjoyed taking disruptive propositions to market. They've traditionally been technical technologies in the SaaS space. And if you think about where High Spot is and other vendors in this place, we're all about helping people like us, salespeople, be more effective in what we do every day, right? Get to our quotas more effectively, more quickly, more consistently. And yet this thing called sales enablement, it's still an emerging category, right? There is still debate over exactly what it is. Is it sales enablement? Is it revenue enablement? Because the two are somewhat aligned, but also a Venn diagram that you've got your overlap, but you also got some areas of difference there. And so I think that what is clear to me as a sales leader, my job has always been about trying to get ourselves to the number predictably, scalability with a level of consistency. And it's pretty clear to me that there's an opportunity for sales enablement platforms to do that, to help our people on the front line and their managers with an understanding of what to know, say, show, and do in a given situation, to help them understand what good looks like in similar situations in the past. How have other people, particularly the high performers in their team, approached a particular topic, approached a particular conversation, and how can we help other people that maybe have less experience in that team model those behaviors, hopefully for an improved outcome. So the ambitions are pretty high. We genuinely want to help change the way that millions of people work around the globe. We genuinely want to specifically help salespeople get better at the jobs that they have, because they are challenging, they are difficult. And I think that's been brought into sharp relief with the onset of COVID and the changes that has driven across our industry. And by the way, I think those are changes that are here to stay. I don't think we'll go back to precisely where we were before March of last year. But also their managers, right? Helping their managers be more effective in how they coach and develop their people over time.
I'm curious, then, because the whole sales enablement area fascinates me, because you're right. How do you look at it? Or is it a case for some sales enablement, it's all about training and coaching? For others, it's about platform selection and tools, for example. It's my experience that people in general, not clearly not everybody, this is an overgeneral comment, will by default look for shortcuts, look for the easy way to do things, look for the template, look for the boilerplate. And what I'm curious about is, where's the line between spoon-feeding people and conditioning them for success?
Ultimately, I think the word you use, conditioning, is quite an important one. It's quite an important principle. And this goes back to, I guess, the principles of situational leadership, and how do you adapt how you work with somebody according to the experience and the knowledge that they have, and somebody that is perhaps less experienced, you might need to be a little bit more directive. And actually, to use your words, spoon feed them. And that's okay, right? That might actually be quite appropriate. But over time, I think it's important to move people away from being spoon-fed so that they can start to apply the principles of what you've taught them, what you've helped them learn, but apply it in a thoughtful, intelligent way. Because the problem with spoon-feeding is, whilst there may be broad similarities between many conversations, no two conversations are identical. If we were to repeat our conversation that we've had today along the same threads tomorrow, we would use different words. We would probably go off down different paths and tracks. And I think it's the same in sales or account management or service, right? There are fundamental principles that one wishes to apply, and one can learn those over time, but you need to apply them in the specific context of that conversation. And so when that comes back to enablement, I think there are some occasions when we do need to provide a model of what good looks like, whether that's a role play, a video, whatever it might be. But the ultimate game, the game changer, is not having people simply regurgitate verbatim every single word. Actually, the ultimate game is people understand the story, that they understand the principles behind that narrative, so that they can take those principles into a given situation and apply them in a thoughtful, intelligent, and engaging manner.
Yeah, you're right. It's the give a man a fish, you feed him for a day, teach a man a fish, you feed him for a lifetime. I think, to use your example earlier, in an environment where giving man a fish is picking up the phone, sorry, not even picking up the phone, is taking your phone and sending a message to Uber Eats. I think we have to work harder at helping people discover the importance. I don't want to say joy, it's probably over-egging it, but the importance of actually figuring stuff out.
I agree entirely. There are certain principles, again, to go back to that messaging, but one of the most exciting things that I think I get to see is how people take ownership of that message, but then craft it in a way that is meaningful for them, in a way that they can bring in their experiences, their rich tapestry of experiences, and apply that within a given conversation. That's what true mastery is about, right? True mastery, to go back to your piano analogy, is actually one day being such a master that actually you don't need that sheet music, because you can just be in front of the piano in that moment, applying everything you've learned to be able to play that particular piece. Or, hey, if that's your style, maybe to be a jazz player with all the improvisation they do. Yeah. No sheet music there, just 3-4 guys and girls just jamming and bouncing off each other.
Yeah. Maybe that's, again, we'll add it to the list. Celebrating mastery is one of those things that we could do to move things along, because it's when mastery is replaced by tools, then mastery gets hurt as a concept and we lose sight of how important it is. I'm curious, Andy, what you do in your spare time to relax and unwind.
So I won't be surprised, based on what we talked about earlier, that I try and stay fit. So I do a fair amount of open water swimming. I've always enjoyed swimming. Not particularly good at it, but I love to go and splash around. I've also, when I was growing up, I enjoyed racing dinghies. A dear friend, lifelong friend of mine, we used to race Fireball 17-foot two-man dinghies. We used to race them around Chew Valley Lake and other places. Now, I'm not so sure I'd want to go doing that. Now I'm in my 50s, but I do enjoy sailing. And so that's morphed for me into offshore sailing. I've got my offshore skipper's license. Is something I did just as a piece of personal development last year. I studied for that. I got qualified for that. So now that's something that I'm hoping to pursue increasingly as time goes on. Beyond that, it's the usual friends and families. That network has been super important over the last year, but I could be throwing my whole career. So friends, family, a little bit of fitness, and a bit of sailing.
Yeah. With that sailing license, you may be able to do a little wine runs over to France now that the GB is out of the EU.
Absolutely. Following all of the important customs regulations.
Yeah, you're a man for diplomacy. I've noticed that. You actually display an inordinate level of self-awareness. I don't know if anybody's ever said that to you before. I'm curious to know where it comes from.
I don't know. At times in my career, I think people have encouraged me to look at my blind spots. The trouble with blind spots is you're blind to them. So it's go look at your blind spots. That's actually not the most helpful advice I've ever had. But having said that, I know I've got blind spots. And sometimes I need other people to help me with those. And one of the things that I've learned over time is that it's okay to go and ask for feedback. It's actually really important, particularly when you lead teams, to get that regular feedback. And I think when I was with Oracle, I was part of a leadership development program there that took me to the Ross School of Business at the University of Michigan. And I hadn't mentioned it before, but it's coming to my mind now. That was really formative for me. It was a three-week course where we learned about leadership. And I think one of the things that was really reinforced for me there was when the Ross School of Business looked at leadership across the ages, there were common traits for what were deemed to be the best leaders. And one of those traits was vulnerability. And that awareness, it's okay to be vulnerable. It's okay to say you don't have the answers. It's okay to ask for feedback. Because guess what? Feedback, when it's given, when it's thoughtful, is such a gift. It allows you to improve. It allows you to understand those blind spots that you might not otherwise know about. So again, I'm struggling to tell you where that comes from. It's probably a little bit of accidental discovery, which has then been reinforced through the impact that's had. But no, that's very kind and generous. I try and be thoughtful in all that I do.
I think you also have to have a very strong ego. I don't mean big, strong as in resilient, and with a sense of humility. I think that comes with that allows self-awareness to flourish. I think if you don't have that, feedback is too painful to seek it out. Therefore, you lose the gift of the feedback, and therefore you don't develop the self-awareness. And I'm curious, were you always like that? Were you always comfortable with hearing about flaws and areas to develop as much as you were about strengths?
Candidly, no. No, I think certainly earlier in my career, because of this drive to want to be the best that I possibly could, I can think of it circumstances where people genuinely were trying to be helpful, and I probably didn't react in the same way that I would react now. But that's okay. I think it's about that self-awareness. It's about understanding that just because people give you feedback, it doesn't mean you have to agree with it. But I think if you refuse to engage with it and at least explore it, you lose an opportunity to learn something about yourself that might be uncomfortable, but equally something that might be transformational. So I think you use the word humility, hugely important. Be humble, right? Good leaders are humble, they're open, they're transparent. Doesn't mean that we operate in a democracy. Doesn't mean that we shirk some of the difficult decisions. But I think the more you can get the views and the perspectives from other people, the better informed you are when you come to collaborative decisions or individual decisions.
Yeah. I think that humility as well, it's easy to spot in people. I think it becomes evident pretty early on in engagements. And from my experience, it makes me want to follow them, which I guess is the definition of leadership. People want to follow you.
Yeah, I think that's a really important part. As I said before, it's about, I think, providing an environment, creating an environment where people want to do great things and giving them their wings. And that's one of the greatest privileges that I think we have as leaders. I can think of a number of people that I've worked with that whose careers have gone from being an SDR. Yeah, one guy I remember hiring, he was a mechanic in a Porsche garage, brought him on as an SDR. He's now a second stroke, third line leader for a large software company. And you know what? He's absolutely incredible at what he does. And it's nice to think that I had some small influence and to help him along the way. He always had that innate ability. And so I'm not laying any claim to that. But the fact that I spent some of my career with him is incredibly rewarding.
Yeah. Yeah. Andy, I hate to say this, we are running up on time against the buffers. I want to respect your time. Two quick things. One, I have to say this. If you ever get tired of being a sales leader, you have a shoo-in job of being a late-night DJ. You have a wonderful voice. You have this great timbre in your voice that would just to ease the night in with a glass of wine. It's perfect, absolutely perfect. So if you ever want to, on the side, maybe do a little bit of that, I can tell you now, you've got a ready audience. You talked earlier about people who influenced you. You mentioned the likes of Churchill, etc. If there was a statue built in your honour with a plaque at the base of it, what would you like it to say about you?
Father, son, husband, friend, and colleague.
Yep, I like it. It's really simple. It's to the point. When you said father, this is the my upbringing. When you said father, son, in my head, I was going, Holy Ghost.
That would be novel.
That's maybe a different type of statue. I love it. Ali, it's been an absolute pleasure, a joy to talk to you today. It really has. You're a fascinating character, and I've thoroughly enjoyed it. Thank you so much for being my guest. I said to anybody listening to this, if you enjoyed it a fraction as much as I have, please consider giving the podcast a review. It would be really helpful. Ali Champion, thank you so much for being my guest today.
Paul, my absolute pleasure. Thank you.